Welcome to Blue Collar Mystics, the under-the-hood approach to the depths of human consciousness. So many mysteries, so little time, so many big words. That's why we aim to take the mystical and make it practical, usable in your everyday life. And you know, we want to hear from you. We want to hear your story. What happened when you started asking yourself the real questions? Like, who am I? What is this? Is it a hologram? Is this some kind of weird cosmic joke? Hey, these are the questions that we are trying to get to the bottom of as we explore the final rabbit hole together here as Blue Collar Mystics. What's up, everybody? How's it going out there, Blue Collar Mystics? It is great to be here. Thanks for checking out the show. I'm really excited. Thanks for taking the time to come and explore the final rabbit hole. We got an awesome show for everybody today. Lots of cool stuff is happening, and I couldn't be any more excited. Please be sure to rate the show. Share it out. It costs you nothing. Check out the links in the description and connect with us. Come check us out on Telegram and our Facebook group. We would love to connect with you. That's really what this is all about, exploring the depths of consciousness. My friend Will had said the coolest thing today, and I couldn't agree with more. I just want to throw it out there and plug that, because we were just talking about, you know, echo chambers and basically every rabbit hole, it feels rapid. Every rabbit hole ends in an echo chamber, right? Like, so it's pretty interesting to think about like that. So why not explore? Explore as many as you possibly can, knowing that, understanding that, and having fun with it. We've been talking a lot about the Illuminati. This is the third part of the series with Paranoid American. Super stoked to have Thomas Gorantz on the show again. And joining us all the way from the left coast, Mr. Admiral Hitz, James Thomas. How's it going, James?
Hey, you know, I got no complaints, man. Just finished the first leg of my summer tour. It came out to hook up a bunch of friends on the West Coast with some medicine, the gongs and stuff before we head into Burning Man and get into that fall tour. And man, I tell you, things have been pretty goddamn amazing. I just filed for a nonprofit where we're going to be providing stress reduction services to veterans and medical professionals and first responders. And I even in the initial phases of that launch, I've gotten two gigs, and I'm probably going to be playing at a hospital, a hospital picnic next Friday. And so things are just kind of opening up. I found a woman that wants to help me write some grants, and just the more that I share the truth, people want to help me. So, you know, it's like we got a really good thing going on, and just got to retool the new project and go back to Tennessee and start building the program from the ground up. So really excited to actually get back to the East Coast now.
Yeah. That's not something a lot of people expect to hear themselves say. It's true. But it ain't so bad over here on the East Coast. It's going good. I'm enjoying it. I love it here. The mountains are beautiful. I've been up there a lot. Really enjoying that. I'm going to start shooting some videos and stuff up there because it's so pretty, and sharing the wealth with everybody out there. Thomas, thank you so much for being here, dude. I'm so excited about this series, and I'm really stoked that you were willing to do it.
Yeah, likewise, man. My absolute favorite topic, or at least top three without question. So
man, flew in my head one day. I was like, man, you know, I want to know more about this, and I could probably like look up a bunch of videos or whatever, or I could just hit you up and be like, let's talk about it. I know you spent a lot of time looking into this stuff, and that is so freaking cool. And so now we can kind of move on. If you guys haven't seen the history, we really kind of went through the history, the first episode, and it's a great episode. The story couldn't be any more ridiculous and ironic and hilarious. And then we kind of talked about some spells and stuff with Joe Roop. And now we want to talk a little bit about this lingering phenomenon, these symbols that are still here in plain view all over the place all the time. For what reasons, we don't even know. You shared with me a Michael Tesserion clip, which I'll throw in the live chat. I forgot to put it in the description. That is really cool and interesting. If you can take the film quality, it is super duper enlightening and really cool. But yeah, man, I'm so excited to kind of get into this stuff. The symbology stuff has always been really interesting to me, and we see it everywhere. So I say, lead us and let's dive right in. If it's your favorite topic, that just makes it all the more better, all the juicier, you know?
So that was a great recap. So the first one, we kind of talked about the historical Bavarian Illuminati and Adam Weishaupt and Baron von Neij, and just how it was a bunch of guys that were flying by the seat of their pants, making grand promises to anyone that was, you know, had a checkbook or had some kind of knowledge to share. And even though that kind of fell in such a crazy comedic fashion, it almost seems like it was completely made up, but it's one of the coolest stories ever. So the first one. And then we kind of talked about how some of those magical practices and rituals, and specifically as it grew in from the Bavarian Illuminati into like French Freemasonry, and how Freemasonry spread. And now we're kind of talking about modern day. And I think there's like the two prongs. So when someone mentions the Illuminati in normal conversation, typically they're not talking about Adam Weishaupt and the Bavarian Illuminati of 1776. They're talking about Jay-Z and Lady Gaga and maybe like Epstein and stuff.
Yeah,
so that's kind of what we're talking about here is that modern day version. And why are, you know, is Jay-Z associated with the Illuminati out of all the different groups that could be out there, and why did they persist? And then beyond just that name, you know, what is it with kind of secret societies and different aspects, maybe even specifically the entertainment industry, especially since you can see that like modern politicians just can't get enough of slobbering over Hollywood stars and vice versa, right? Hollywood stars can't get enough of slobbering over politicians. So there's definitely some kind of weird symbiotic relationship in there, you know, like two different funguses growing off of each other somehow. So I think this is kind of setting up the premise of what we're going to play around in today. This is the sandbox.
That's awesome. Yeah, this is so interesting because you see a lot of these symbols all the time. You know, the checkerboard floor, the triangle, the single eye, you know. And you hear a lot of different theories and ideas about the symbolism, what it means. I've heard a lot. You know, the Christians certainly think it's all, you know, very demonic or satanic. You know, other people might say they may have a different take where, you know, it's like the symbol could mean more than one thing. I tend to fall into that category myself, in that, you know, these symbols can speak directly to our subconscious mind. They have certain meanings. Oftentimes it could be astrological. It could be, you know, other esoteric symbols. It could be symbols of families. I mean, it could be a lot of different things, but I think it's really interesting. And the fact that all of these symbols that are from the Illuminati, which we, as we know, ended, we won't spoil the surprise on how that happened, but that this kind of culture carries over and then gets embedded into Western media, all of the culture, really. It's proliferate throughout Western culture. Do you think it was like, do you think that there's ancient stuff that we have all the Illuminati stuff, but do you think that even before that, there's still these symbols going back even to ancient Greece?
Yep. So I've got a theory that I propose that I think, I don't know if it's groundbreaking, but it's something novel because I haven't found a lot of people researching into it. But not too long ago, maybe within the last decade, there's been a lot of studies where they take like MRI imaging and they'll show someone a picture of a symbol or, you know, an animal or something. And they can take the MRI images without seeing what they showed the subject, and then basically like reverse engineer the image that they've shown them. So they've got some examples where they'll show someone like a jaguar, and the resulting image, it's not quite a jaguar, but it's got the colors, it's got kind of like the rough shapes and everything. But then they've done more specific ones where it's almost like those old tests where they would try to test to see if you had ESP, where it would have like the triangle and the waves and the X. It's got a certain name. You know what I'm talking about. It's got like a series of cards. They do something like that, and that exact same test where they can scan the MRI, they can tell if you saw an X or a plus or a circle or a square, and if it was a square, if it was just the outline of the square, or if the square was filled in. All of this information can be directly extrapolated from MRI imaging. So without getting too much further into the nerd bits there, I really do think that there's like, how long did it take for us to train dog, like pointer dogs, right? To like develop that behavior to where they're just born and just as puppies, they just point at something because they don't know, but it's, that was a specific behavior that was bred over time. And that had become solidified almost at like a genetic level. So I really do think that these very simple symbolic shapes of, you know, holy trinities and crosses and any sort of astrological symbols, because if you imagine before there was widespread illustrations that were mass copied and before there was TV and movies, everyone just had the night sky. That was their theater. That was all you watched all day, every day. You know what I mean? It was just the change in the seasons, and you were looking for these symbols everywhere. So I really do think deep down, we kind of have these symbols baked into our brain, like in a very literal and physical in a way. And over time, people have found out that they can exploit that and like, oh, if I use this certain symbol or this certain color, it just attracts people to it, or it attracts energy. And so I really do think that there's some element of that in it. And I don't know if there's anyone that would be willing to research it and then advertise it, because it's like, if you find it, it's like, oh, I'm not going to tell everyone about this.
Right.
You know, this is my secret gold.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of like Pavlov's dogs, but for imagery, right? Like, so it's pretty crazy that they could extrapolate from the brain what it was imprinted into the subconscious.
And if anyone cared, just so I'm not just throwing a bunch of random stuff out there, this was at the Computational Neuroscience Laboratories in Kyoto, Japan. And there was one paper written in 2017 and a whole bunch of others that kind of based on that, they kind of splintered out, and people have been doing all sorts of different tests on it. Huh. So it's legit. It's 100% legit. And it's mind blowing that you can, you know, basically like read someone's mind. You can see what they've been looking at by just doing an MRI scan on them.
That's pretty incredible. Yeah, even James and I were talking earlier about NLP. I know you have some experience studying that. And that's a really good example, too, of some way to sort of instruct someone more or less subconsciously to do what you want them to do, right?
Is that rhetoric, that hidden skill. And I would to wrap it all back to secret societies and the Illuminati, like once they find out what these special tools are that let you wield all this power, first, they figure out how to consolidate and monopolize on them. So they're the ones that hold the power and know how rhetoric works and know how symbols work. And then they start dumbing down everybody else. So it's like, as you gain your information, you lower everyone else. So it's almost like, you know, it's kind of like a multiplication factor. It's not just like a slow decline. It's like all of a sudden you're taking quantum leaps in knowledge ahead of everybody.
Yeah, that's a lot of leverage right there, right? Like if you can keep the good information for yourself and then not allow it to out to everywhere else, then yeah, you definitely widen that gap between the people who know and the people who don't know, the haves and the have-nots, or the hows and the how-tos. that's pretty fascinating. Yeah, the Tessarion clip was super interesting. There were some really really cool things that he points out in there as far as like heritage and maybe even family businesses, even like going back and back and back into pirates and pirates and all that stuff, and the 322 and the skull and bones and all this kind of stuff. And that was pretty interesting. I know that is kind of an older clip, and there's maybe a little something to even just that whole experience in itself with Tessarion. I've seen a lot of his other work, but that was the first time I'd ever seen that video. And I found it to be like really straightforward and informative, and just have some really cool insights about like these symbols, what they mean. Like, for instance, light, you know, using light as a symbol, and your soul is like, yes, I want light. I love light. So they put light with something that's maybe toxic for you, and you still are attracted to that thing. You know what I'm saying? It's enticing to you even more so because there's this subliminal signal that's being broadcast to your inner self.
Like his example here was like a beer. And so they're selling you like the beer light. And the question was that they actually spell it L-I-G-H-T. So in addition to thinking, oh, this is healthier for me and it'll make me lighter, you know what I mean? Because it's like the diet version. But also there's this subliminal message of, you know, I want to consume light. Light is what, you know, gives everything life. Light comes from the sun. And so why wouldn't I want to put light in my body? That would make me a better, you know, person. That's that subliminal aspect of it. And that's my favorite part of this whole concept of, you know, sneaking subliminal messages and understanding symbols. And I guess that's the, I always come back to sort of a martial art aspect of it, where if you understand what the symbols can mean and how they can affect you, like that's your first line of self-defense to see that, you know, that punch flying at you. That's how you know how to bob and weave a little bit. Otherwise, you just get punched right in the face every single time, right?
Right. You have no ability to defend yourself. You're just there, you know, and it's always just beaming into that. I know there's definitely something to it. You know, different roommates I've had, people I've lived with, I've had certain, you know, cravings. Let's say I live with somebody who ate a lot of fast food, and fast food would be out on the table. I would see it, you know, more and more, and then eat late at night and do
all of a sudden
like
you're hearing the jingles and they're sticking in your ear a little bit more, right?
I start getting hungry late because I'm starting
to want,
you want
to live moss more and more.
Yeah, that's right. It's time for a fourth meal, you know? Yeah, totally. So, you know, there's definitely, you know, a lot of power in the images. And I have another book that's really interesting on my bookshelf. Well,
and you mentioned that Pavlov bell. I just want to mention every Taco Bell ad ends in that Pavlovian bing trigger, right? Bung.
Yeah. Yeah, dude, it totally does. And I mean, that's good, effective marketing. That's what they say, you know, about that. And it's definitely attention grabbing, and it's definitely a meme in itself, you know, something that's so repetitive over and over and over and over and over again, that it's really kind of hard to, it's hard to defend yourself from it. You have to insulate yourself from it. I think once you become aware, and we can talk a little bit about that too, it's a little bit easier to guard your mind. But you still have to be intentional about that. You know, you can't just get sloppy because it'll just seep back right in. You know, I mean, the billboards is one thing that I notice myself getting distracted by a lot because I'm driving a lot. But
One of my best techniques for using billboard, this is going to sound really kind of like off on a weird nerdy tangent, but to use billboards for your advantage and to not have them have any effect on you, I'd use billboards as practice to like, can I translate every letter into a number and every number into a letter before I drive past it or I travel past it or whatever. And now all of a sudden it becomes like a mnemonic technique and like a reason to keep training the mind, and it completely destroys whatever message the billboard saying, because I'm just looking at each letter and turning it into a number. And it's one of those things where I'm like actively making sure that that's what I do when I see a billboard. Now I'm not reading it and being, you know, maybe I am, because then I get off at the very next exit, ended up getting two Big Macs. I just right. realized that. Yeah, my bad.
No, that's really good. I think that's really smart. We can talk, you know, about that kind of stuff, just different techniques and ways to kind of keep yourself from just kind of getting lured into that or hypnotized by it, or what even would you call it, you know? I know James, you're very intentional about how you eat as one thing, right? Like, I know for a fact you haven't eaten, like, garbage food in ages and ages, which we all have our own struggles, you know what I mean? But talk a little bit about, you know, how you might guard yourself against stuff like that.
I mean, you know, the number one thing is shopping on the outside of the grocery store. There's no like colorful labels and marketing rhetoric on a package of meat or on a mushroom or a green pepper. You know, the colors and symbols and I guess the positive correlation between the stimuli really has a strong connection. You know, this has definitely been in situations before where I go in the grocery store and I'm like, I'm going to buy something healthy. And then you come out with something shitty and it's just like, oh, I just got hornswoggled by the nostalgic version of me when I was 5 years old and like Nutter Flutter butter or something or other. And now I just made a $5 purchase that, you know, I take that first bite and you could tell that it's a lower vibration food. And you're like, oh man, they just stole $5 from me. I'm not even fucking eat this. That's good. You know, and that's the thing is, you know, the more you are aware and mindful of what your long-term goals are, you know, for me, for one, is I'd much rather have clear skin, a healthy heart, and good teeth than to constantly be stimulated by the lower vibration of processed sugar, right? But the three-year-old inside of you with the jingles of your kid, you're like, hey, I remember all this. And then the sound, you know, that jingle now permeates and with the stimuli and the memory of what that tastes like. And the next thing you know, you're like, you're all in. And then you have to really re-establish and your foundation and stay ahead of the game. But, you know, it's definitely a struggle out there. And the more you aren't aware, the more susceptible you're going to be.
Yeah, it's definitely true. Like, as soon as I noticed that, too, that the bags had been sitting out and, you know, these things. Because, like, a habit, it just takes over. It's like Napoleon Hill talks about hypnotic rhythm. You know, like, you do it, you do it, you do it, you do it. And then before you know it, like, it's a pendulum. It's a energetic informational structure. It's a thing that has its own, you know, swing to it that you're kind of used to. You build a habit, and through, you know, knowing about it, you can definitely guard yourself away, but you totally have to be intentional. It's so funny, you don't see marketing campaigns for broccoli, you know what I mean? Like, what are the things that aren't, well,
if efforts? You do, it's usually from the government, either from in some kind of agricultural service, or it's quite literally like a health initiative, like, hey, fatties, stop fucking cramming the Twinkies and eat some broccoli once in a while, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, it's the things that they don't advertise for, you know, and like you said.
There was a lot, if you look at old Soviet advertisements when USSR was still together, they actually had a large number of just like fruit and vegetable commercials, just like, hey, stay healthy. We need
beets.
We need some infantry on that front line. Eat that's beets and right. potatoes.
That's right. Beets and potatoes, man. That's right. Oh my God. That's great. Well, yeah, man. So let's talk a little bit about, it was Sesame Street's fault. Somebody said that my daughter knew McDonald's before she could speak. It was Sesame Street's fault.
When you got Cookie Monster. And on top of that too, James brought up a really good point of like, it's so easy to talk to that three-year-old and everybody. And I mean, like clockwork, right? Every time like another decade passes, it's like they bring back Count Chocula and Boo Berry and, you know, like the old retro style cereal boxes, so that as you're walking down that aisle, it's like, that's what Lucky Charms looked like when I was seven, you know? And there's and maybe a strained connection, but that same sort of like mysticism that Illuminati and secret societies, it's always presenting like, you know, we're in older times, so much simpler. It wasn't like, you know, the yesteryear. Wasn't that just like a grander time where people were, you know, full of more wisdom and just more thoughtful? This Lucky Charms is kind of like that. It might not be, a thousand years back, but it's far enough back that, you know, just buy this. You'll love it.
Yeah, yeah. You remember it. You know, it's like the old Dorito bag, the vintage. And you're like, oh, shit. Like, it's still nacho cheese, sprayed corn.
But this is quite literally, this is a like, if we go in NLP terms, right? We can come up with any sort of terms. I kind of see it the same thing. But in NLP terms, this is that anchor that, you know, they stuck that anchor deep down inside you in all the commercials and the back of comic books and, you know, staring at the back of that cereal box in the morning as you're eating it. And then they can trigger that anchor now, years later, decades later.
Yep. It's amazing. It really is. Yeah. And like, even now, you see it, Domino's is doing the Stranger Things thing. And the Stranger Things was like such a big hit TV show. I thought it was really well done in many ways, but it definitely had that Goonies nostalgia to it that just drew me right in. And that's the sort of branding that they go with, you know, with the Domino's pizza box kind of thing too. Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't bring the Noid all the way back for that one.
They probably will, bro.
Yeah.
Oh, he's coming. 2023. That's
right. Avoid the Noid. Oh my God, that's great. Yeah, it was really, really an interesting dip into. I've seen a lot of different people talk a lot of. It wasn't the food; it was the toy. Somebody said,
"Yeah, man."
I mean, that's yeah. There's.
I absolutely remember buying cereal that tasted like rubber. But it had like a decoder ring or something in it. And yeah. It was like, and you can't tell your parents, like, they just spent $4 on this cereal that you absolutely hate just because you wanted the stupid toy inside. So,
yeah, like the Ovaltine thing in the Christmas story. He gets this decoder ring, and guess what? Go drink your Ovaltine, kids. Oh, it's so funny. Oh, my God.
You mentioned, too, that Sirion video. I just wanted to tap on that again, because that one I was mentioning before we started, that was one of my first pills, whatever color pill it would have, black pill or white pill or something. But I believe it was from a 2002 conspiracy con, and he got up and he had just released, or he was about to release, this DVD series called Origin and Oracles. And it covers all sorts of like astrology and, you know, symbolism in the media and everything. However, the presentation that he gave at that conspiracy con was called The Subversive Use of Sacred Symbolism in the Media. And it's like a Cliff's Notes version of everything that he had been working up to until that point. And he mentions at one point in the video that he had started this research when he was 13 years old. And I think he's pushing 40 or something at the time of that speech. So anyways, he goes real deep into it, but he mentions something that at the very beginning that I think is a good kicking off point, and that's the monopoly of making sure that if you understand how to interpret symbolism and you can make sure that you're like the key guardian of that information to give it to other people and decide who gets it, that monopoly just over symbolism itself becomes one of the greatest powers that you could possibly yield.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's kind of like real how much power that winds up being. And especially, I think it accumulates over time too, right? Like it's like the anchor where there's like, it's building. And then the more momentum and the more leverage. And it goes, you know, really on and on. I was really impressed with the Tessarion video. It's like I said, there was a lot of other things. There are a lot of parallels that I've seen in other people's presentations, Mark Passio being one, but there were some other things that really stood out that were completely different and unique about, you know, kind of where he was going, talking about the lineages and exactly how the images were being portrayed and what they meant too, right? Like going into some of the astrological meanings and stuff like that. And also to say, hey, you know, you can actually use these symbols yourself. This is what it means. And this is why it's used this specific way. And so why not use, if you can, you know, use that information, create your own logo around that, you know, play your own sort of game in and express yourself symbologically as well.
I think another good point too, that he brings up in that is how it trains people into this left-brained condition, where if you stop looking at symbols, because symbols leaves a lot more open to the interpretation, it's a little bit more flexible. He mentions the word playful, which I think is probably the best way to describe symbols, is that they are playful. They kind of are interactive in a way that, depending on the context and the mood and a whole bunch of other things that aren't obvious, will lead to different interpretations of those symbols. A symbol can have different side effects. And one of the analogies that I try to think of is that if you were to give, like, you're going out to go camping or something, if I just give you a map and I'm kind of like just drawing it on like a napkin, almost like treasure map style, I'm like, yeah, it's kind of like a little mountain range, it looks like a freaking skeleton or something, and yeah, there's like a lake or something, and you know, the thing, like, they're not relational to each other in any kind of real way, but it's giving you these landmarks, these symbols that represent reality. That kind of leads you to more of like an organic adventure sort of approach to it, where like you understand what's out there in reality, but you're going to discover it for yourself, versus you've got a GPS that's telling you exactly like 500 meters north, you know, take an immediate right, go around this thing. Like you can still get to that same place, but now all of a sudden you're just following this very strict path and you're only inputting like pure logic and pure data and sending it directly to your, you know, your brain that's just turning it into directions and following the directions versus, hey, you know, I know that, you know, Owen drew this while he was like stoned out of his mind and he was like, you know, four deep in, he had just drank like a fifth to the head. So I know that the mountain range and this lake aren't probably that close together, but like, I know there's like a lake somewhere and like just being in that kind of mentality, all of a sudden, like you have to be more alert. You know, it's the difference too, of like that person walking around, looking at their phone, like walking into shit, even though they kind of know where they're going versus someone that's just out exploring the city, looking for a park to go and hang out in. Like they're going to be way more alert, way more in the moment, way more, less susceptible to just random things happening to them. And that's kind of the whole focus here, is that if you train a society to not be able to interpret symbols or to look at symbols as like, oh, I don't know what that is, I need someone to tell me, I need instructions, I need like, you know, the manual. Once society starts thinking in those terms and they stop being creative, then all of a sudden, again, that monopoly just pushes further, because then everyone that is willing to step outside the box and kind of think of different things, they sort of hold this invisible power over everyone else that hasn't been groomed like that.
I mean, another defense to this type of thing would be meditation, though, like clearing the brain and really looking in and giving yourself time to not let these outside influences affect you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just taking space, being aware that it's there, you can insulate yourself, you know, from it. And then, you know, it's all about, I think, the process of widening the space between stimulus and response, right? Like that's what we're all kind of working on, and meditation, absolutely great for that. Just being able to know about this stuff is really, really helpful too. And that brings me back to kind of be like, hey, let's, you know, start working it around to why these Illuminati symbols that are apparently from this, you know, this, well, we did, like we said, we did the history of it, and the Illuminati was disbanded, at least publicly, in the early 1800s, I believe. Isn't that right? Or late 1700s?
Late 1700s, yeah.
It wasn't around, but like 20 years, maybe, something like that. It wasn't a lot.
It was a bit of a flash in the pan, but it was also like a... Yeah, it was like a one hit wonder 90s rap group that it's like a group that sampled an old 60s song that no one remembers, but then that single made everyone remember that 60s band more than the group that kind of revived it. It's sort of that's how I see the Bavarian Illuminati. They were that one hit wonder that made like an old jazz group, you know, get popular again because they sampled an old jazz song.
Yeah, funky. that's pretty much it, right? Like, flash in the pan is good to say. Very, like I said, man, if you guys didn't check it out, the first episode's really, really, really awesome and fun, and an interesting ending. But, you know, as far as we know, that's it. That's how far that sort of runs out. But then somehow these specific symbols stick around throughout our culture and throughout our entire society, you know, even though we're hundreds of years away from when that actually happened, when it stomped out. Why do you think these particular symbols have stuck around so long?
I mean, I've got a cut to the chase kind of spoiler alert here, but I really think that it's almost entirely on the shoulders of Robert Anton Wilson and the whole sort of clan of Discordianism and Slack and Bob Dobbs, you know, the Church of Bob Dobbs. I think that they, or Robert Anton Wilson specifically, decided, I'm going to make the Bavarian Illuminati this thing that people just blame all of the woes of, you know, modern sort of society on. And it was extremely successful. And it was kind of like a hilarious way that he did it. And I'm pretty confident. Like, I feel like 75% confident that's the reason why the Bavarian Illuminati specifically is still known today. It was because it was like a funny little prank and it worked out very well, and it's still working.
I think that's hilarious, and it wouldn't surprise me at all. I love Robert Anton Wilson's work. I've been a big fan of his for a long, long time. Prometheus Rising, one of the best books. It's definitely in my top five I've ever read.
Talk about training your right side of your brain. That book is specifically, it's like, you know, laser focused on having you just think of crazy things and stepping outside your patterns all day.
And it's full of exercises, you know, like there's like every single chapter has exercises in it for you to actually do that are basically like pranks themselves, right? Like it's all kind of like this loop that he kind of gets you to ask yourself these questions that are kind of unanswerable from a subjective awareness. And then here you are trying to figure out, like, I think one of the exercises that I can remember is like to find a quarter on the ground. And then after you find the quarter on the ground, you ask yourself if you put the quarter there or if you noticed the quarter on the ground because you were looking for it. Or if you just randomly came across it, right? Like, so how are you supposed to really truly answer that question? It seems that whatever the thinker thinks, the prover proves, is kind of the whole point of that entire book. And for that to be the case, I think that's pretty awesome. So because of Robert Anton Wilson, you think Jay-Z and Beyonce are covering.
Yeah, without Robert Anton Wilson, everyone would just say that they're in the Freemasons, because that would be the next one after that. But yeah, I think that's why they get specifically mentioned as the Illuminati. And it's so much more fun to say, right?
I was just about to say it has so much better of a ring to it than, oh, Mason, you know, it's like.
Well, and actually I believe the Bavarian Illuminati, they kind of like workshopped a few different names. And I think the one that they landed on was the Perfectibalists, but that one just does not have the same ring. Yo, yo, Perfectibalists, you know what I mean? Like the Illuminati just rolls off the tongue. It rhymes with more stuff. So that's the one that's persisted. I think the other one was they wanted to call themselves like the Order of the Bee, which is sounds a little bit wimpy compared to Illuminati, right?
That's pretty weak. Yeah, Perfectibalist. That sounds like an autistic group to me. Somewhat, you know, like that's it's too specific. You know, that has to. And then the Order of the Bee is, I mean, it's just a.
It's cute.
It's
cute. You expect them to come out with like little bee suits or something, right?
Like the Blind Melon video. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that makes sense, though. It's interesting to think about that because he does use a lot of that. So, you know, we could talk a little bit about the dollar and stuff, too. Like these symbols, they've just been around for ages and ages and ages. Why do we think we're seeing it on, you know, currency as well? Because there's a little bit of a gap in there.
Well, we're talking about the Great Seal, which has the Eye of Providence on it, which if you notice the eyeball or the eye at the top of the pyramid, it's two things. One, it's that all-seeing eye of God or the great architect or whoever, you know, think it is watching over the nation, but also that the pyramid is missing that capstone. So it's kind of saying that this nation or whatever this symbol represents is an unfinished work that is still being worked upon, you know, by the Masons.
Yeah. The builders, right?
The builders,
and I think everybody is a Mason. Everybody's Illuminati. That's the trick, is that you're it, you know, like we're all it too. Like everybody's creating this world. We're all participants in it and active creators. You know, so I think Mason, builder, you know, creator. It's like the Lego movie, one of my favorite movies ever. I rant about the Lego movie all the time because not any of the sequels, only the first one. All the sequels are trash.
But you're the very, purist. Yeah, Lego movie purist.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I really do. I see a lot of Spartacus is also, you know.
So I got to ask, how much of you loving the Lego movie could just be pure nostalgia?
It's a good question because I definitely played with Legos as a kid, but I think the
message, if it were the Duplo movie, would you still be as attached to it?
Definitely not. I wouldn't even care about it. You know, it wouldn't matter to me. Well,
remember,
all.
Like Playmobil tried to make a thing too, right? They were trying to do something with their property, and it was like, get the hell out of here, Playmobil. No one really played with you. You just kind of sat there and like looked pretty.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they were so huge and clunky too, you know. The Legos, yeah, I mean the Legos even used, you know, Star Wars and all these other things to make themselves even more relevant, calling back even more and deepening those anchors. And But I do say, like, even if the Lego movie was, let's say, just some, you know, movie that was like Despicable Me, like that's not something that was around that was, you know, my, during my childhood, those weird one-eyed things or whatever. But if it was just a regular movie of whatever, I just think that Lego movie, it does such a good job of illustrating the idea of, you know, being a builder, what it's like to, I guess I really related to that main character who was like the most average. I mean, look at me, dude. I'm like the most generic looking white dude. People get me confused with Tom Segura all the time. And, you know, in my act to talk about like being a Nintendo Wii avatar, that's basically, you know, what I am to be. I'm like a bouncer.
You could just wear like the arm cast and be Tom Segura post NBA game for Halloween, true. Right?
Yeah, it would be a very easy costume to buy. It's true, man. Like, yeah, we look like every other, you know, bald bearded white dude. You know, we all look the same, like a bouncer in the metaverse. You know what I mean? Like just. But yeah, it's interesting to think that this whole thing is even a troll, insofar as, being called back to and giving so much power, because as much power as we give something is however much it has, right? Like we actually give the merit to the thing. It's like if somebody saw something I know these particular symbols and images, we talked about it at the beginning of the episode. They do have certain effects on us at a subconscious level. But also learning what that is and, you know, being able to use it and, you know, have a little bit of a safeguard insulation there. And also knowing that it also has the value that we give it too. So the more that we like lean into it and see it as a symbol of evil and despair and hate or whatever we attribute that to it, then it does have that reflection. You know, the more people that kind of buy into that narrative, the more power that it does have in that way.
And it's getting a little bit scarier too, because I would say the natural progression of that would probably just be this concept of emojis, where you've got symbols, but you ever heard that? I'm going to butcher this, but there's a statement of like, boring people talk about other people, and then like slightly more interesting people talk about things. But, you know, the most interesting people talk about ideas. Yep. So it goes from like your local to a little bit more global to like the completely abstract. I think that same thing kind of applies to symbols, where if we're talking about some esoteric sacred geometry, it's more in that higher level aspect. You have to understand a lot of different things to put together the entire picture. Then you've got like the things where maybe it's like memes, where like it takes a little bit of cultural knowledge to understand. But then you've got like these emojis where it's still a symbol. So I guess you could say you're symbolically literate if you understand what emojis mean, but it also encapsulates this wide range of variety of emotion. Like we were saying, like that adventure through the forest or whatever, all of a sudden this like little emoji with like a heart or something, that all of a sudden does have like a really real effect on you, because your brain understands this heart means someone cares, but also a heart we're taught since, you know, children is like, well, that's love, and that's, you know, people admiring you, and like you want hearts. So then of course, like I always think, like the very first month that YouTube was around or Instagram was around, no one cared how many views or likes you got on some stupid video site that no one had ever heard of. But then fast forward 20 years, like some people, you know, live or die by how many, you know, what their stats are tracking like. And again, this kind of boils back down to like, how many hearts am I getting? How many smiley faces am I getting? How many of these symbols am I accumulating? But now it's almost like a complete perversion of what a symbol is supposed to be. A symbol is meant to kind of be like a milestone to guide you on your path, where now it's like a graven image. It's almost like, you know, thou shalt not create graven images and worship idols. Like, holy hell, man, if a like count or a play count or, you know, your thumbs up share number isn't sort of what a graven image is at this point, I don't know what would be, really.
Yeah, you know, what about subverted imagery? You know, it's like something like the swastika meaning peace, and then it being taken over by, you know, the Nazis. And, you know, for centuries or thousands of years, it had a different meaning. and then they subvert that meeting, you know. So what do you think about that type of stuff?
I think it's all built into the symbols, because now that symbol has this whole other layer on top of it. And that's exactly what a symbol is meant to do. You know, depending on your time period and when you're looking at it, it can mean so many different things. So, I mean, it's not that the swastika now has like a better, you know, it's like, yeah. Oh, it's so much more complex, you know, that's got that robust flavor into it. It's not quite like that. It's more of an attribution to how powerful the symbol is. That, you know, it gets assigned all these extra meanings and it keeps carrying on because that symbol itself was, it's already baked in the back of our head. If the swastika, or the Nazi symbol was just some abstract shape that they invented like on the spot, I don't think it would have had the staying power or the same, you know, power of driving the psyche as actually taking something that you might've seen in other contexts throughout your entire life up to that point.
I mean, yeah, even as a little kid, I drew a swastika in the sand, not knowing what it was. And I got the shit kicked out of me by my mother for it. You know, it's just, it was a natural thing to put four lines off a cross.
It's like a pinwheel or windmill, yeah, or it's, yeah, so many. Exactly.
Phase conjugation by Dan Winter talks about the movements between the icosahedron or the dodecahedron and the icosahedron, and it creates that movement that's conjugating between it, actually shows a swastika in that transformation. And that's like, he says that that's the basis of gravity, which is a really interesting thing.
That's actually, I've never heard that. That's awesome.
Check out Dan Winter's stuff, man. Like, it's pretty, he's a really interesting mathematician, that has a lot of really interesting theories. It's really, I've heard a lot of his talks. It's really interesting, but he pointed it out in his work in a digital like remake of this conjugation. And it showed it in its transformation. It was like, wow. So, you know, kind of, if he says that that's connected to gravity, and he kind of has a theory that gravity is God, then, those two things would connect on a very subconscious level. So, I mean, it's some interesting theories. I don't know how true or how proven they are, but within his model, it shows it.
I could be persuaded very easily. Fun fact too, I believe that the dodecahedron was such a revered shape that it was one of the few things that I'm probably butchering all this, but the Pythagoreans, I believe it was like punishment by death if you revealed just the dodecahedron. If you just showed someone like, hey, check out this shape, it's called a dodecahedron, like that would have been enough for them to just like, you know, he's gotta go, bro. He's leaking those, like, those deep, you know. Now you tell someone what a dodecahedron is, like, great, bro, get the hell out of the way, I'm trying to watch, you know, freaking Beauty and the Geek or whatever, right?
Yes, exactly.
But and I want to point out too that I've never heard that before. I find that so fascinating that it's essentially like the blending of two different shapes. And that's where the swastika symbol kind of comes from. Because my mind goes right to the dudes that discovered the double helix shape. I think they were on like LSD or something. But it was just like a vision in the head where this like abstract shape started coming together. And it's not like they actually had seen it for themselves at this point. It was just like all the information and the context and just deep introspection and, you know, the Akashic record sneaking in, whatever the hell it was that made that vision. That could be that same thing that someone just, you know, somewhere sees like again, we're saying swastika, not in the Nazi term, but in like the geometric shape. But they see this and realize, man, like there's something to that, just like the guy that saw the double helix was like, hey, there's something to that here. Now, luckily, the guy that saw the double helix was already in that exact frame of research and knew exactly how to apply that shape. But people probably see these sort of, you know, sacred geometry and just repeating patterns or what are called form constants. A lot of people that they trip and they see the exact same shapes and the same patterns and everything are called form constants. These could very much be some like deep genetic programming that we're still just kind of piecing together. Just like that, the double helix, if it's literally what makes up our DNA, it's so hard for me to not believe, maybe, you know, dumb to believe this, but I feel like just that structure and that shape has some kind of power over us if you see it out in nature, because it's literally, you know, part of us.
Hey, quick joke. What's the difference between sacred geometry and regular geometry?
What's that?
$500.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people talk about a lot of these symbols that are written, you know, whether it be any of them, but the representation of the two, I don't want to say swastika anymore. I don't know. YouTube, your channel shut down. No, but as you said, you were talking in the geometric sense. But I think it's a lot like of 2D shapes. It's like all these ancient cultures trying to convey messages through symbols. Right. And so like they can only draw in two dimensions. But when you bring that, when you bring like, let's say like the Star of Solomon or whatever, right? Like there's the two triangles. Well, if you bring that into, you know, into the third dimension, well, now it's like
a tetrahedron.
Right. And so thank you for saving me, because I was going to fuck that up, dude. I was going to eat shit so hard on that. But the same thing is true with like the cross, right? If you were to fold the cross up, it's a cube. And that's one particular symbol that we do see a lot of, especially more and more. That shit's everywhere. But to think that a cube could also be a cross, like that blew my mind, because it's a 2D representation of what might be a third dimensional object. Plus $500.
When, and you bring up a good point too, of like the same geometric shape showing up in different cultures. I think again, that kind of goes back to this unbased theory that I'm developing, that these shapes are, you know, baked into us already, and it's just a matter of being able to leverage them and kind of suss them out and use them for different purposes.
I think so too. Yeah. I definitely think there's something to these symbols already, you know, speaking to us on a level. We kind of touched on that at the beginning of the episode, and to be able to leverage that and use it and speak that, it's kind of a language, right? Like it's what it is.
Well, in a universal language, right? Because if we're talking about letters, each letter itself is a symbol, but the letter by itself doesn't actually have the same message that a more abstract symbol would have. And those abstract symbols are the ones that can communicate across cultural barriers and language barriers. Whereas if you start talking about actual written language or words, now all of a sudden, like, you could have all the information in your culture, but you can't share it to anyone outside your culture because they can't decipher it. But if you've got these kind of pictograms, I guess there's always examples, extremes, like there's still hieroglyphics that we're still trying to figure out what the hell it means, even though it's all pictures and not necessarily letters. However, in a general sense, you can put together what a symbol, or at least figure out what the feeling or the general relationship of the shapes and ratios and, you know, kind of like if you're listening to music, you might not understand how to read music or how to write music, but you know what a melody is. You kind of know when things are in harmony, you know, when things are discordant. It's kind of that same thing when you're looking at just symbol interpretation, versus you're not going to sit down and read an entire book. And I think Sarion has a great analogy here, where he says that the Bible is based on the Torah, and the Bible and the Torah are both just books full of words, although the Torah gets into the words actually are symbols that mean things. But the Torah, he postulates, is based on the tarot, and the tarot is entirely symbols with no letters or numbers to really worry about compared to the amount of symbolism that's baked into them.
Yeah, I was actually just going to – I'm happy you made that connection, because I was going to – jump in on that, the Torah and tarot.
Jump in, man, because honestly, once we start talking about tarot is where my expertise just evaporates immediately.
It's definitely not in my expertise, and it's something I'm just studying lightly in the current. But you know, if you look in through some of the symbology in the cards, especially like the weight deck, the Arthur weight, and you can see I think it's the high priestess or the magician that has the Torah in his or her sleeve. And I mean, it's like literally a representation of the tarot. And then, you know, once you get into the tarot, I mean, if even at one card on the I forget what they call the grouping without the numbers, But each of those cards have so much symbolism in it. And if you
the major arcana?
Yeah, Michael Tazarian's has a course on it. And literally, some cards are 4 hours breakdown. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I've watched his presentation on the major arcana, and it probably took me like 40 hours to get through it. It was really heavy duty.
And I think that kind of mentality too, like once you've stared at a single tarot card for 4 hours and you've picked apart every little, like the direction that the crest of the top of the waves in the background and the ocean are facing, and like how high the peak of the mountain is compared to like where the dog's head is, like all of these different things actually can mean very specific things within the tarot. And once you get into that mentality, that's when you can just go out into the world and look at a situation from so many different angles, where you're not looking for like, you know, looking like at the back of the tarot card, like where's the little diagram that like shows me what everything is. And granted, you know, if you watch a 40 hours of lecture, it's not too much different. But again, the basis there is that you're actually learning how to interpret symbols. And it's not that knowing what that major arcana card is. I mean, great if you want to tell fortunes and you want to be great at party tricks and stuff, but it's actually being able to look at it and see all those symbols and then realize, oh, wow, everything that I ever see, there could be 50 different things that I'm not seeing unless I know exactly what I'm looking for. And that's that key that's opening up in your mind that's has nothing to do with the Rider-Waite tarot or, you know, any other design of the tarot. It's the mentality that it exhibits.
That's actually the, the tarot gets into magic. And I don't mean fortune teller. I mean, actually you absorbing that symbolism and connecting with it on a deep esoteric level. And that's one of the three major components of unlocking your own mystery.
I think it comes down to recognizing correspondence, right? Like one of those primary laws of the universe, the idea of correspondence. It's like the more that you understand these symbols and their multifaceted meanings, as we were talking about before, like how they're stacked. Like I could, you know, write something to you symbologically and you would take maybe more or less out of it than somebody else, maybe still get the same basic ideas, but recognizing those correspondences, like the magician card, you know, the tarot or the lover's card, right? Like that's really about creation and these two elements coming together. Like I saw, there's a great channel called Mind and Magic. The guy's awesome. Frauder Xavier. Some of you guys might've heard, he never shows his face, but he goes through, he's got Mystery School playlists. I saw it years and years ago. I discovered that playlist and he goes through and talks about that particular card. It's beautiful the way that he describes it, because he's talking about the process of creation, where in that card, you'll notice the feminine is looking up at the angel or God or the figure of, you know, that's beyond. And then the masculine is cueing off of the female, representing the conscious mind. So you got the subconscious mind that's connected to all of infinity. And then you've got the conscious mind, the masculine, the male, that's cueing off of that subconscious point and taking, and that's how creation happens, right? Like the conscious mind can't look directly at God. Like the subconscious mind is connected to all the ether, infinity, God, whatever you want to call that.
Ineffable, right? Like it's right. Impossible to experience because of our lowly existence.
Yeah. And I think it translates to, like, they even have the themed decks. Homeboy's got a Harry Potter deck. But I mean, it all translates, you know. You can do, like, there's tons of different decks. I see lots of different decks with like weird stuff on them, frankly. Like some of them don't even seem like they're really communicating that much of a message with the images in the decks. But I mean, whatever. I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's whatever you want to do as the practitioner and whatever symbols, you know, speak to you. But I think, you know, there's some stuff that's embedded in there that's really deep. Have you ever listened to Andy Rouse or any of those guys talk about Bach Saga?
I just caught the Bach Saga that was on Tinfoil Hat recently with Danunaki Dan, Rising from the Ashes, and a couple other people. Yeah.
Yeah. Andy Rouse. He's got the Deep Share podcast. I love his work. He's a cool, cool dude. He's been talking about Bach Saga for ages and ages. And so the idea that we could talk symbologically, you know, beyond culture and beyond tongue. You know, if maybe if we went even further back, going into just a more universal language, maybe there are more than just that one. But I think symbology in itself is even one that we could consider, like kind of one of those. And there could even be a building block from Bach Saga into these symbols and communicating beyond. You know, just beyond words.
Well, I think the Bach Saga, and you mentioned too, the Star Wars and Lego, and not just the nostalgia factor, but now we're talking about archetypes, which are sort of symbolic roles within a story. And that's exactly like Bach Saga mentions it. If we're going to talking about the Bible, if we're talking about Harry Potter, you know, some mentioned the Harry Potter tarot, they all follow this very similar Joseph Campbell-esque hero's journey. And like, that's one other thing that can, you know, it translates well across cultures and languages, and anyone can sit and watch, you know, the Bambi movie and not know what the hell they're talking about and see, you know, like the kid growing up and it loses the parent and it has to fend for it on its own. And everyone can relate to that. Even if you're not a deer that saw your mom get shot and die in a fire or whatever, you can relate to that archetype that it represents. And again, that's one of those things that, like I'm not trying to just strain it back to this Illuminati secret society monopoly. But again, if you understand what powerful archetypes are, you can intentionally surround someone. You can say like, oh, this person I want to influence, they don't have that wise old mentor in their life. And I can just, I know a wise old mentor. I'll just plop him into this family and put that guy into this, their sphere. And all of a sudden, like I control that mentor, who then puts the information into the person that's looking up to that mentor. Or, you know, you've got like all the just the wide gamut of the thing. And I also look at it as like analogies and ratios. So again, if you're good with music and you understand the ratio between notes, then unless someone tells you like, hey, that's basically, you know, color, it's all vibrations and ratios and how far many steps from this color is the same as how many far away steps from this musical note. And they all kind of play by the same rules. But unless if someone doesn't teach you that, you might just think like, oh yeah, I understand color and that's all I'm ever going to be good at. And again, that's that monopoly of information where if I understand that it's the ratios that I get, and it's that, like if I can look at that tarot card and I can see all the 50 symbols in it. So then when I go in, I, you know, look at my car that won't start, right? I might be able to think of 50 different reasons why it might not start. And that's that same kind of mentality that will allow someone to think like the Renaissance man sort of thinking of like, hey, I understand music. I probably can figure out how to paint. And if I can figure out how to do that, I can probably figure out how to like do architecture. And then all of a sudden it's like, man, like all of these things are just requiring the same discipline of work and knowledge and information just applied in vastly different ways. And again, if you control all that information, you can prevent people from ever figuring out how to do more than the one thing that they're trained to do in this kind of like Prussian, you know, again, yep, Bavarian Prussian system of
compartmentalization.
Like, yeah. Fit, like find out your specialty, earn your degree in that specialty, you know, spend 20, 30 years just developing that specialty and just grind it all the way down and don't expand and do a million different things.
I even think being a generalist is like, I don't know. There's the saying, and I love saying this to people because it blew my mind when I learned there were two parts to it. But like, I consider myself to be very much a generalist, but I feel like it's poo-pooed on to be a generalist in a lot of ways. Modern culture, it might have to do with that compartmentalization.
Well, you should just specialize, Owen. You should only know one thing your whole life. Yeah. Well, you know, it's just.
No, there's something to having a niche too, and being able to have a specialty and to be able to dial that in too. So, you know, I'm not trying to shit on the other side or fling poo. There should be no doo-doo in any of this. This should all be clean, good stuff. But jack of all trades, master of none, you hear that all the time, but you don't hear the second part of that phrase. It's jack of all trades, master of none, but oft times better than master of one. So that reframes the whole thing. You hear just that meme all the time, you know, growing up or whatever, jack of all trades, master of none, jack of all trades, master of none. But it's like, there's a whole second part to that. And that's that, someone who is a generalist, that they could potentially pick up something and maybe see it in a new way. Maybe they have an understanding that's a little bit wider. You know, they might be able to, like a line producer on a film set has to basically see that all the departments are working in unison and in line and things are going well, you know, within that. That's very much a general position, but it's somebody that has to make sure that everything is going smoothly. They might be able to step in to one department and see something that needs to be done, and maybe even have a different
fresh perspective.
Yeah, fresh perspective to maybe be able to, and maybe it'd be a terrible idea too, but they may have like a new good idea or try something in a new way.
Well, not just that, because if you take the line producer and you imagine all the people that they're coordinating, if you had to take, let's say that like everyone above that line producer all of a sudden just got COVID, or you know, they just got hit by a bus, and now it's up to anyone at your disposal to sort of, you know, bring the production back on track. The line producer being the generalist and seeing how all these different parts work, they're probably the best one to kind of like, you know, take over the helm, to become the new captain of that ship, essentially. Even if you've got like the best dancer, the best singer, the world's best dancer might not be able to do the most simple tasks that the line producer needs to do. And again, it's like the difference between that specialist and generalist.
Yeah. And nothing wrong with either one, right? Like it's all about being you and bringing your talent to the table, whatever that is, if it's, you know, generalist, specialist. But I just feel like there's always been this sort of dark light on being a generalist. And I just want to kind of show the other side. I think that's really cool. A lot of people that I've spoken to and we've talked to about that have gotten a relief. It's given me a relief and made me feel like, oh, okay, well, cool. Like, you know, you just keep on chipping away. And then I think you can carve out a path from being a generalist that you have some unique specialties and different skills and talents that you've developed along the way that you can kind of lean on and, you know, are some, maybe some of your better skills and talents, but you can still, you know, do all these.
I would almost flip it too and say that, If you think you're a specialist in something, like what was Leonardo da Vinci a specialist in, right? There was too many things that he was so damn good at that there wasn't just like, you know, it was almost like he was a generalist in being a specialist. Like everything he did, he was a specialist in. But the message in there being that if you are the world's greatest dancer, there's no reason that you couldn't also be the world's greatest five or six other things.
Sure.
Because you already know what greatness is and what, like, just understanding how to get to greatness, regardless of what lane you're in, that's kind of like the most important aspect of it.
That's a great insight. Yeah, I think that relates, right? Like, and you know, and you can also relate dance to another medium too, especially if you're a Renaissance man, you know, or a Renaissance human being, right? Like you're a good sculptor, you're a good artist at canvas, or you're good at charcoal or music. Like those start to translate over and you start to see parallels in all those different art forms.
Well, you could argue that they all sort of translate. I mean, it might not be necessarily like if you can draw like really cool cartoon characters really well, you might not also be able to do like theoretical physics in the same breath. But again, like if you understand what it takes to be disciplined and practice and move that information, we mentioned earlier on when we were talking, but there's sort of like three phases of attention. And I always go to computers because I'm just like an absolute computer nerd, but it would be the same thing as practice or magic or NLP training. But essentially, you've got your sensory memory. This is like what I'm looking at this exact moment. And if like a bird flies by, I know that bird flew by. And if you ask me 5 seconds later, hey, did you see a bird fly by? I might remember, but like 30 seconds later, it's gone. It's completely, it never even went into my short-term memory. If something I'm focused on and I intentionally pay attention to it, then it goes into my short-term memory. But if I don't do something with it and practice it or repeat it, then it also eventually just kind of gets stale, and you know, when my computer reboots, I fall asleep, that's gone forever, you know, unless I go through like therapy and past regressions and stuff. But if you sit there and you take the thing that was first in your focus, you put it into your short-term memory, and then you just keep regurgitating it and looking at it in different ways and introspecting it, eventually it kind of moves over to your long-term storage, it moves over to your hard drive, right? So now it's And that exact process, I really think, is what you can do. Like, if you become a specialist, you've done this one thing so many times, it's in your long-term memory. But now you can do that to so many other things. It's not like your hard drive just fills up. I don't think that a single human being that's ever lived has ever filled their hard drive up. You know, like, everyone's been capable of more than they were able to achieve before they died.
Oh, man. Yeah, that, I don't think truer words have ever been spoken. It's so funny. Even the people that I hear who I think, like, how do you even manage, bro? Like, how do you even do all that? And they're like, well, you don't know how much I could have done if I would have just.
Well, you know, the necessity pulls that up, because there was a point in my life in the 90s where I remembered every single phone number, credit card, every single thing that was important in my life. And now that information is outsourced in our phones and our databases and all these things. So, I mean, I think that your ability to remember things is a direct correlation to your survival needs and what the environment dictates.
And it's a luxury too, right? Like, I always bring this up of, like, all those old Renaissance dudes that had the luxury of storing all this esoteric information about math and geometry in their memory palaces. Like, they probably weren't out hunting for food to, like, feed their families. And, you know, like, there was a certain level of luxury and cushiness that you've achieved in order to pursue these loftier, like, the joke too of, like, Manly Palmer Hall, right? Like the dude was probably, like, very well manicured and probably had some fairly soft palms, because the dude just read books all day, every day, and more power to him because he was able to release that knowledge out. But he might not be the first one I'd want to put in the back of my wagon for the Oregon Trail game. You know what I mean? Like, I want the banker, or I want the hunter. I want, like, some more oxen. I don't want Manly Palmer Hall next to me in the wagon.
Just lecturing us the whole way.
Well, let's be true, though. I probably don't want 95% of the population in that wagon. They got a lot of learning to do before they go on that trail.
No doubt. Oh, man, that's so funny. Yeah, man, it's such a cool and interesting thing, and something that I've loved the symbology, and as I've learned more and more about it, it's just become more and more pervasive and noticeable. Of course, when you start to notice something, you start to see it everywhere. As far as, like, understanding symbols, symbology, are there any resources that you recommend, Thomas, that are good places to start? Someone had asked in the chat a little bit earlier, my friend Mike did.
The Sarion one is great, although it's a little bit dated, and I'm not 100% on board on every single example. Like, one of the examples that he brings up that I'll go on is, he's got, like, a bunch of just, like, random corporate logos. It's got, like, a checkerboard, or one's got, like, you know, some other, like, a triangle or something. I've worked at enough graphic design companies to know that, more often than not, the dude is just searching for, like, abstract shapes, yeah. Drops it on there, throws the logo name. So it's not like every time you see a checkerboard, you know, like, there was some Bavarian secret society at work for, like, 20 years figuring out the best way to ilk you out of your money. It was probably just some underpaid, you know, graphic designer putting together.
Right. Absolutely.
There's no intent, though. It'll incite certain things in your psyche from having being.
Well, the very reason that the reason that they grabbed that triangle, or they grabbed that checkerboard, is probably the reason why it's in there. But it's not always because the
they're
the
not
fresh
even
college
conscious.
Grad. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Spirit guides, man.
That's
spirit
power.
Guides.
Yeah, that's right.
But for some of my absolute top recommendations, and this is not a recommendation based on accuracy necessarily, because, again, we're talking about symbols are playful and flexible. They can mean many different things. Tex-Mars Codex Magica is one of my favorite all-time books. It's like, it's thick. It's a thick book. It's probably like 8.5 by 11 or bigger. And it just goes through, like, secret handshakes and pagan artwork and statues. Cool. He's got a Tex-Mars also has another book, I think, called Mysteries and Stone or something like that, where it's all just statues and fountains and buildings. Those are two of my favorite, just because they are so massive and in depth. And then, of course, I can't ever not mention OG Daddy Manly P. Hall's Secret Teaching of All Ages, especially the ones that have all the full color inserts and everything. That one, That one is so cool because like he'll just show you a picture of Isis and break down every single symbol, almost like Sarion does with the tarot deck, right? And then finally, you know, because my reptilian overlords are beaming it into my brain, I gotta say that reading any sort of public Freemasonry, basically Bridge to Light, which is a summary of Albert Pike's work for the Scottish Rite, is really good. And pretty much anything you can find online that'll break down all the different symbols of Freemasonry, not because Freemasonry has the answers, but because Freemasonry very much how like the Bavarian Illuminati was this vessel for taking ancient symbols and bringing them into like the modern day of, you know, 1700s, 1800s, that still kind of exists today. And that thread is worth pulling on where you can understand what does, like, for example, the checkerboard, depending on the context, but checkerboard is usually, if you're talking to Michael Sarion or to Jordan Maxwell, they'll say the checkerboard is to remind you that you're just a pawn in the game and that everything's a game and that you're being used as a pawn. In a Freemason or Illuminati aspect, the checkerboard represents that life doesn't let you just stay in the white lane. You can't just always be good and you can't just always be bad, you know, white or black. Nothing's completely binary. In fact, that your life is going to be made up of this woven fabric of good and bad, which kind of blends into like a gray area. So there might be times in your life when you're not doing the right thing. You're standing on the black square and then you kind of like, you know, straighten up and fly right. Now you're on that white square. But if you look like you're standing on the white square right now, there's not an easy way to just always step on white squares. Nothing but, I mean, obviously if you just like work perfectly and kind of tiptoe on them. But the concept here is that, you know, life is not good and bad. It's a fabric of all of it woven together. And that mentality, again, it can be liberating where it's like, maybe in like an evil way, but it's like, I don't always have to be good, but I also don't always have to be bad. I do what the situation calls for.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of different analyses on these images. And one I really liked is really about transcending duality. You know, it's kind of hard to see this image. I don't know how to zoom in on it. But there's a checkerboard floor here and then there's a ladder and, you know, I would butcher it if I tried to say what everything in here meant, but actually Thomas, you probably could, give us a little,
I'd get killed, bro. They'd bury me in the sands of the sea
right.
Where the tide ebbs and flows right. 24 hours. Yeah, bro.
Right. But there's a lot of, but there's a lot of symbology here. And just, I think the idea of transcending duality, you know, being aware, you know, of what you just said, like sometimes I'm going to be on this part, sometimes I'm going to be on that part, you know, we're trying to balance, you know, there's really ultimately no black or white. I've heard it said like, you know, like the people who are down here are on the square, meaning they're, you know, their four circuits of consciousness are the only things that are developed.
And that's such a great example too, the square and the plum, because, and, you know, I'll get dinged points. I'll probably get dinged points for not knowing the exact one, but one of them is, I believe is a square, is there to remind you to keep your passions within measure. And just like James was saying, you know, when you go to the grocery store, that three-year-old would love to get those Lucky Charms because, you know, it remembers it. But if you can keep your, you know, those sort of like gut instincts, or not gut instincts, but like those things that are luring you to those center aisles, you know, where all the processed stuff is, that's kind of not keeping your passions in check and, not being fully measured. So just by seeing this symbol, you know, if you had a tattoo or if you had it on a shirt, or if you just saw a right angle anywhere, and you're Freemason, be like, oh yeah, that right angle reminds me to keep myself in check. And this stupid example, but that might be, you know, you're in the grocery store, you see a right angle and you're like, I don't need these Lucky Charms because I just reminded myself to keep my passions within bounds. And this is part of that, is being, you know, disciplined and structured. So then you put it in and you go and buy just broccoli and the whole cloud, you know, the whole crowd claps for you and then Einstein's there and gives you a pat on the back.
Yeah. You know, I'd also go as far as to say that, you know, the answers are inside of you for this stuff. And the more that you meditate and contemplate these things, the more those universal answers will come to you versus trying to take somebody else's interpretation, wherever that may come from.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that. Yeah, anymore. I mean, that's really what, you know, it all comes back to the self anyway, right? Like, whether it's Eastern or Western, it's really, all this stuff is really just about ourselves, how we relate.
It's a little bit of a paradox too, though, because sometimes people don't realize it's in them unless someone else tells them it's in them, right? It's such a funny catch 22.
It is. It is. It can be really kind of ironic and even
because not every person would just by themselves come to the realization of like, oh, I can just figure this all out.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But that's where movies come into play too. A deep, because you're just each frame is just a new image, right? And so you're being thrown 3,600 images per minute when you're watching a movie, and like that's
well. Now we're getting back into Illuminati pop culture and stuff, and that's movies, TV. Is probably one of the best examples in my mind because this, in a good and a bad way, but I'll start with the bad way in that this allows you to like live out different experiences, you know, through a movie screen, through someone else, like vicariously living through this actor.
Safely.
And for some that, safely. And for some that could be a good thing because it opens their mind up. It puts them into a new mentality they wouldn't have been put in before. Maybe it make, you know, someone watches Schindler's List or something and they're like, oh man, I was a raging racist and horrible Nazi. And now I'm not because I see this different aspect of it. But there's also a sort of a bad part where someone's like, watches someone go through this life-changing experience. They, you know, they do the hero's journey. They overcome their addiction and all of their vices. That also could be like cathartic in that, oh man, that's great. Now I don't have to, you know, to give up my alcoholism because I just watched this movie and I know what it would feel like to give it up. And I've been through the motions. So I'm going to go and I'll see you at the bar afterwards. So there's an aspect of that. And I guess outside of that flipping example too, but just people, you know, achieving their dreams. If you see enough movies where you feel like you live through the main character and achieve your dreams, that could even chip away at like your own motivation to achieve your own actual dreams because you're so used to it playing out in front of you. If you need that fix of like, I need to feel like I've accomplished something. Some people can get that fixed by watching a movie of someone accomplishing something,
right? Or finishing a series. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I finished this series. I finished it. I did something, you know, like it does kind of feel that way. It's a really good point. And really back to what you were talking about the archetypes, Joseph Campbell, Carl Jung, and the Enneagram, you know, I think these are all the same kind of things. Like we said, it's all within us. It's all us. And so these are all different ways to sort of show us all the different archetypes and how we are interacting with ourselves. The Enneagram, I love it. I'm a big advocate.
Don't get me started.
yeah, exactly. As far as like writing narrative and writing and understanding how people interact and stuff, like it is incredibly helpful. It's different from the archetypes, but it's the same. It's another.
Yeah. You have an example?
So like, just the archetype of, on the wheel, I can show you, actually real quick. It's easier to just do a little bit of a visual example if I can pull up an image real quick. But, that's blurry. Hang on one second. So I don't have an example where I can correspond it to to Jung's archetypes. It, you know, right now, like on the spot, but I can show you how the archetypes work on the Enneagram. So here we go. So let's say you have someone who, and this is just an individual thing. I think we could extrapolate this in a meta way. I'm a type two myself, right? So altruist. This even has like the archetypes here as close as you can get, but you see a lot of people kind of argue these.
Yeah, you're the like the cool cute sidekick that comes around and becomes like the best friend of the main character, right?
Well, you're the helper. the helper, right?
Yeah, that's Thumper.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. No, that's exactly right. And so, you know, I wouldn't agree with what they have here as far as how they relate it to Jung's archetypes or the personality type archetypes, because I'm an INFP. They have it as a type nine, which, you know, that kind of makes sense too. The thing about this particular wheel is everyone would have something that they're sort of endeared to here. So as a type two, you can see there's a couple of different lines. One is running toward a type four and the other is running toward a type eight. So the one that is going toward a type 8 is descending, right? So they'd be the one who's like, oh, I don't need to do anything. I've already felt the hero's journey from watching Cool Runnings or whatever. And then the type 4 is the individualist, the artist. So as a type 2, for me, the healthy progression is to go from type 2 to type 4 toward the individualist and toward that artistic inclination. The type 4 is the one on this wheel that's like, you can't put me on an Enneagram. That doesn't work. And that's that individualist sort of mentality. But they're linked together here. So if I were to descend, it would be into the 8. And realist is an interesting term here. Usually you see like the challenger here. And I think entertainer and pragmatists are pretty relatively, it's close enough, right? Like there's a lot of different ways to interpret it. But a challenger, somebody who, you know, is clever and not necessarily angry, but as a type two, when I would descend, it would be from burying a bunch of, things that I was upset about and then ultimately exploding. So that challenge would all come out all at once. So that's the descent of the type two, right? And so knowing that, it makes me realize, okay, I need to work toward this type four and be aware that what we do as the altruist is we help people and we forget to ask when we need something.
Need individualism too.
Right. Thrive. We need strong boundaries. We need to remember boundaries. And then whenever we need something, we have to remember to ask. Otherwise, we just assume that people are going to pick up on our needs, because intuitively, a two would kind of pick up on people's needs and be like, oh, what do you need help with? And then start to kind of help them with their process. It's just kind of a natural sort of gift that they tend to have. And each one has their own gifts and their own disposition. And what's cool about it is at the top, the 9, the harmonist is how it is listed here, sees from the entire circle. And you'll see too that the 6, 9 and the 3 are all linked together, which is a pretty interesting
Tesla, right?
That's the 3, 6, 9.
Yeah.
Yep.
Secret. So there's people
study this their whole life. Like the lady that came and taught our group, Vanessa Fernandez, she's amazing, like unreal. And she mostly just does like corporate work and stuff. But yeah, it all corresponds. And I might not necessarily agree that with these archetypes in place. But you know, whatever. The idea is that they are all here on this wheel. And then from a story perspective, you're going to see maybe you could do an example, James, of a 7, because I know that's something that's pretty familiar with you as far as the hero's journey of that 7.
Yeah, you know, I've been using this. I am a 7, and when I was writing my story, I made the protagonist a 7. And the interesting thing with the 7 is the 7 is kind of like that jester, party animal, fun guy. And when the 7 regresses, it goes to a very righteous, self-righteous, indignant, bossy, tell you what to do, I'm always right kind of fellow. But when it ascends, the 7 goes to the 5, and it's a lot less extrovert and becomes more studious and involved and more grounded in collecting information and synergizes in a way that that evens, balances out that extroverted concept or the extroverted tendency. And, I also want to go as far as to say that your number can change based on your environments and over time. So, you know, you might be a 7 or a 2 now, but
sure.
Life can kick you down a little bit with different circumstances and different environments and cause a whole new, outlook or response mechanism. And so they're really just kind of guidelines to motivations and behavior. Whereas like a 7 and a 4 might do the exact same thing, but they're doing that same behavior as a completely different motivated perspective. And so it really just kind of breaks down the ability to see those motivations.
I love that too, because if we're talking about that whole flexible, playful aspect of symbolism, here it is right here. I mean, there's not an exact formula that tells you, you know, how to go from the 7 to the 5 and what exact steps you need to make and what are the exact environmental factors that might make you go from being a catalyst into a loyalist. Those things just kind of happen naturally. And if you don't understand, I mean, this might not be like the map, but if you understand this and how these different personas and archetypes can like relate to each other, then as you feel yourself changing or you see your environment changing, you can kind of get your bearing and figure out, okay, I might have relatively been around a six, and now I feel like I might be closer to like a nine now. Just knowing that and having that tool in your tool set puts you leagues ahead of someone that's just kind of thrust into this process with no map and no awareness of the variation. Even if these numbers don't mean dick, right? If the colors don't mean anything and the numbers don't actually correspond, just that you have a game plan. It's like a horrible adage that I'll misparaphrase, but like everyone following a really shitty plan is better than, you know, nobody following any plan.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So during the writing of my movie, my last screenplay, I've learned what a seven was. And then I read the most important words that I've ever read in my entire life. That actually was probably a very strong kickoff to my own personal healing. And it's the seven likes to have a lot of fun to escape pain. And I was very aware that I had degenerated to the one because I was bossy and just very self-righteous and all these things, right? But right when I read that the seven runs from pain, I had been following the five ascension to a T. I had literally stopped moving, stopped interacting, only started reading, was completely studious and like trying to find the answers and knowing that I didn't have them all. And so when my behavior is, you know, really extreme in the sense that I was able to once see this dynamic laid out in front of me, be able to look at all of it. And once I read that word, those words that said, you run from pain by having fun, I completely stepped into all the pain in my life. And once I did that and realized that that's what I've been doing my whole life, it allowed me to reverse the tendency of living in fear and not allowing the idea of being hurt or the idea of feeling pain to control my current output.
Yeah. One thing I love too, when I discovered I had a similar experience because I first thought I was a seven. I think a lot of people take the test and they come out a seven. So I recommend actually looking into each one, reading a little bit about it, and taking your time, to understand it.
Now, is this a Myers-Briggs test and then you figure out where you're at on that and then that tells you what number you are, or is there a more specific test for the number?
They have a more specific test for the number, but there are better ways to figure out your type. There's even
this is sounding very Prussian.
Well, you know who was really into the Enneagram was oh my gosh, what was his name? He was Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff said that if you understood the Enneagram, it rendered whole libraries useless. And so, you know, what's really cool about it, and I don't want to get too much into my story, but I just didn't understand that, like, putting myself in someone else's shoes, that was me putting myself in their position from my disposition, not me putting myself in their position from their position and their perspective, their disposition.
From their awareness, yeah.
Right, exactly. That's not the same thing as putting you know, yourself in somebody else's shoes. That's me being like, well, I'm going to buy him chocolate, even though he's allergic. I love chocolate. You know what I mean? It's like, that's not putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, you know?
That's when you buy someone else like a birthday present that like you wanted. Yeah. Like, I don't even have an Xbox. Why did you buy me this? Oh, it's the best game ever.
exactly. I mean, people might even really think like they're coming from a place of generosity and love and thinking about you, but they may just not even realize that
they didn't ask your love language first, man.
That's right, dude. You just wanted a coupon for a back rub. You know what I mean? Like, you didn't want a video game, but yeah, no, it's cool for that. And I think, you know, it's also when it comes to these personality tests and things, as James said, like you can shift and things change. And it's really about understanding motivation. That's what's cool about the Enneagram as opposed to like a Myers-Briggs, is because it shows you what the motivation is as opposed to, you know, what these rigid structures and the way that you are and what your personality entails and your horoscope or any of that. It's more about like understanding intrinsically what motivates you and what is it that you're, you know, trying to get and what are, and that other people have different motives and different interests than you do. So, so it widens the playing field and gives you a lot more perspective in that way. So that's my favorite thing about it. And for me, when I read about the two, my friend Scotty introduced me, my buddy Scotty Collin, big shout out, amazing guy, great artist. And he sent me a book by Beatrice Chestnut called The Complete Enneagram, super thick. And then you can, the beginning of it, it's just got a short synopsis of each type. And he was like, man, you know, maybe read a little bit about it, you know, and read about type two. And so I read about type two and it said that type twos often manipulate situations and try to get things without asking. And I was like, I don't do, oh shit. So becoming aware of that made me aware of it, right? Like it was a huge blind spot before I got into it. So it helped me just become a little bit more aware of a part of myself. So that's why we're such like... such cheerleaders for the Enneagram, but
well, and that was a great way to be introduced to it too. Cause take the Illuminati mindset and flip that on its head, right? Where I recognize that you're I recognize that James is a seven. James doesn't know about the system. He doesn't know about the progression and how to like evolve and devolve. And I can keep him in that escapist state of making you always feel like that seven. And just like, you know, push you towards that escapism. Because now it's like I can take that same map and use it to steer you around the map where you don't realize what's going on, but I kind of have a game plan for how I can orchestrate, you know, get again back to the analogy of like the set designer or the line assistant, line
producer, yeah.
The line producer, like that line producer, maybe a director would be a better example here. Like the director might realize like that James at a seven and that you're at a two and I know how to push you around and get you to transition to these different archetypes and in a way that almost like an Illuminati grand chess master only could. But then you apply that to, you know, you're in your middle management job or you're in, you know, in the Walmart checkout line or something. Like you can use these same tools to push people's buttons and get people to do things without them realizing it.
Yep.
Or empower them.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Well, that was the example. Like, yeah. Luckily, you know, Boots, he had a friend that was like, hey, dude, check this out. Look into this. You might be a two. But they could have never said anything and just kind of like, you know, manipulated you from behind the scenes, too.
Well, my writing mentor wrote an entire book about how to write, how to build characters using the Enneagram as motivating factors for the foundation of the characters. And so I didn't even go into the Enneagram as a healing tool. I went in as an artistic tool. And then I learned through the, you know, without trying what all this stuff was. And it blew me away because I wasn't there for, you know, I just needed motivations for my characters. And once I discovered what this tool actually was and did, I was blown away. I was able to any type my whole family.
Well, not to get all cheesy, but I mean, you could say that every character that you ever write is really just a different version of yourself anyways, right?
Absolutely. And that's actually how I do the basis of a lot of my characters is, you know, from that 5-7 or one from the, you know, the regression from the 5 to the 7 or the 7 to the 1, because ultimately with, let's say I choose the seven as a protagonist. Well, the antagonist is going to be the lower end of the D of evolution. So the antagonist is going to be a one, which is the worst parts of that seven. Whereas the arc of the seven now grows to the five, right? And so you literally have an embedded mechanism of the character's arc and the antagonist from the get-go. And all you have to do is layer in the additions of those characters of like, you know, the depth of those characters. So it's
really, and if you got to find out their exact weaknesses and their strengths, you can use that by just looking at where they're at on the map, essentially.
Yeah.
Well, I actually built an entire framework where I could plug in the characters and then plug in all their attributes and then be able to see it all in one spot and be like, who's in this scene? Well, a 3, a 5, and a 9. And so you look at how this 3, 5, and the 9 would interact and what pushes their buttons and how they do.
And now we're talking like, music, man. We're talking about music theory.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because it's all just a big song. It's all sound.
Yeah, I just put it in the chat too. Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's so cool that it comes back to that. I put it in the chat and also just sent you a link to Thomas to because Jeff Lyon's book, it's excellent, dude. One of the opening of the book, he's like, so I bet you've tried to write a story before, and then you got about 3/4 of the way through, and it just fell apart, didn't it? You know, that's how most people it goes, right? And he's like, well, here's why: it's because you don't have a proper, you know, a foundation, a fundamental, elemental kind of foundation to base things off of. So you understand the motivations and the characters, the development before you go into the story. Yeah.
And that's why when you're reading the story and you're using these Enneagram numbers within these characters, you're literally studying these archetypes, and then people feel familiar with them when they're watching or reading them, and they understand like, oh, I know.
That's just like my friend Terry. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you're really hitting the essence of these connectivity or these ability for people to relate and connect with the characters, and they don't even realize it.
And we're talking about this in like an artistic, almost self-help sense. But again, if let's flip this over and take the evil Illuminati aspect of it. Yeah, you got the eye out. But if I'm putting together a huge team, or, you know, like a big reptilian infiltration squad or something, right? Like this same exact map can let me know like how to formulate my team. Like, you don't just want a team of all sevens, probably, I'm guessing, right?
No.
You don't want it like lopsided. So you're going to always find like the right composition for all the different, you know, A squad and B squad, like killers, you know, the sniper squad and the freaking infantry squad. Like, they're going to have general balanced makeups of these same kind of correlations between all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to put the ones and the eights on the front line, right?
Yeah. Well, and I guess the nines are going to be the ones who are kind of the
anti-war.
Yeah, the people who, you know, can kind of see the whole, you know, forest from the trees and all of that kind of stuff. They can see
those are just the officers. They get to sit behind the desk right, and tell everyone else.
They're just the sergeants and the admirals and the
Well, that would be the six. The six is definitely going to be bossing people around and
the six is smart
orders.
Though.
They're organized.
Yeah, they're organized and they understand. Like, they look out for things that could go wrong. You know, like they're already thinking about the things that could go wrong before. They're the worrier, you know, kind of archetype. And so, I have a really good friend, and he's not like a worry wart or anything, but he's just thinking like always ahead of the things that could potentially go wrong and outsmarting those things. You know, he's not like a six would have, like a version of a woman would be a woman that has like everything in her purse that like, she, you know, she's like person, you know, she's got the thing. She's always there. Your lips are chapped, whatever. She's got chapstick or whatever, right? Like always prepared, always thinking ahead about like what challenges may come and thinking about those ahead of time.
So if you were the Adam Weishaupt of the Illuminati, the one that was like, you know, putting the teams together, is that a six or is that a nine?
I think it's probably more of a six.
More
I think
of a
it
six? Might
because the nine is trying to avoid conflict. Mm-hmm. That's the whole thing.
They
with
don't
the nine.
Like conflict.
They don't like conflict, and they're going to avoid it at all costs. And they try to people please and keep everybody from fighting.
Okay, so that's really Baron von Neige. That's the second in charge. Yeah, he's the guy that's harmony. Trying to make up for all the promises that the six is, you know, making. The nine is out there trying to actually fulfill them to make everyone happy about it.
You know, right. I could also see the four being a tyrant as well. Yep. With the individualism and being, you know, and when they're regressing, I believe they regress to the two.
It looks like they click to the one and to the two.
The one is ascension, and the two is the de-ascension or devolve.
Correct.
So I saw someone mention the three world wars. I will mention it really quick, just because it's an interesting topic. But my understanding is that the Albert Pike's mention of the three world wars comes mostly from Leo Taxil's sort of hoaxed version of a bunch of correspondences that apparently he had. Now, I do believe that there is a correlation between the Bavarian Illuminati and the Carbonari, which was the Italian, very political leaning version of secret society, and then Albert Pike, which is sort of the I don't know how to say it. He's like the Wild West cowboy, drunken, racist rant version of secret society. He's kind of that's kind of like the Albert Pike version of it. You know, like head of the KKK sort of origin of all that. But the Third World War, I think, was more of a fabrication from Leo Taxil trying to draw this more physical link between Albert Pike and Mazzini. I'm not sure if it 100% existed, and therefore I'm not sure if the Three World War thing was necessarily something that Albert Pike actually said, although I wouldn't find it hard to believe. And I absolutely believe that Mazzini was all about, I mean, Mazzini was all about war and conflict and just constant revolution. Like, if there was a revolution every weekend, Mazzini would be down for it 100%. That was like the lifeblood. Was like, if I'm not heading a revolution and fighting for my countrymen and, you know, taking back rights, then I'm, you know, like I'm unfulfilled essentially. But there's another one of those threads between the Bavarian Illuminati and all the way here to today.
How does Albert Pike fit in exactly with that?
So the general claim from Leo Taxil and a few other examples, but essentially the Bavarian Illuminati dies out, and there's a claim that Adam Weishaupt passes the baton to Giuseppe Mazzini, and he essentially is like the Italian Bavarian Illuminati. But in reality, the Carbonari had a whole different game. Like, it's the same structure, right? The same archetypes. They had kind of the same maps, but totally different examples. Whereas the Bavarian Illuminati were about Jesuits and education and forming together these groups of specialists that could then monopolize sections of culture. The Carbonari and Mazzini, again, was all about like covertly joining the ranks of different political and military organizations and like breaking it up from within, to the point where like even other Carbonari would infiltrate their other Carbonari brotherhoods. like everyone was like so gung-ho with like overthrowing stuff that like you couldn't ever trust, you know, even your second in command kind of thing. And then the baton apparently was kind of either shared or passed between Mazzini back to Albert Pike, whereas Mazzini took it over for Europe and Italy, and then Pike brought it over to America. Again, I don't know if that lineage is 100% accurate. I do think that the mechanisms and the teachings and the overall structure is shared between all three of those, but the direct link between the three, I think, is more about a Leo Taxil hoax than anything. And that might just be my Freemasonic apologist coming out to just make sure that I don't get assassinated tonight, but whatever. I'll leave that to the viewers to decide.
Copy that. No, that's great, dude. No, that's it's fascinating. It's so interesting, all this stuff, and how it really is the same story over and over, you know, as we just kind of like really from the beginning, just seeing so many things that are pervasive in our society that are just very human. Needs being exploited and people being manipulated and multi-level marketing, basically.
So I've got an example of modern day Illuminati promising esoteric teachings and stuff. So my go-to example is probably Marina Abramovich.
Yeah.
Abramovic.
I think it's Abramovich or Abramovic.
I've got her book. I've read it a couple of times. I 100% think that she is sort of a modern day Adam Weishaupt, where it's like, you know, the spirit cooking and the weird artistic satanic / occult rituals. It really does promise these like esoteric teachings, or I'm going to teach you how to think way outside the box. And look, here I am next to Jacob Rothschild, and here I am next to Lady Gaga, and here I am with all these politicians around me. So clearly I have some secret taboo information that only the elite of the elite get, you know, access to. And again, like, that's exactly the MO of every secret society, specifically Bavarian Illuminati is a great example of this one, of like, look at all these powerful people that are rich and they've got, you know, all these specialists that are on my team. Clearly I've got something that they want. therefore I've got something that you probably want, but you'll never be able to attain it. And that last part of like, but you stupid normies will never be able to get here. That's the selling point to get those Rothschilds and Podestas and Lady Gagas in line. Cause it's like, oh, this really is exclusive. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I've seen like videos of her, like apparently taking Lady Gaga out into the woods and like blindfolding her. And like, didn't she do like a Microsoft ad? And it was so like, people yeah. hated it so much that they just took it down. They were like, no, we're just going to take this down. Yeah, dude, that's so funny. That's so accurate. And like, it makes a total sense because it's really about status, right? Like that's ultimately what it seems to like boil down to with a lot of that stuff, status and having sort of special rights or privileges or access to.
It's an evergreen like grift, man. That yep. grift will last forever away. Through all forms of technology and culture. And like whenever there's that person that's like, ooh, I'm doing something naughty with blood and semen on the walls and I've got secret information. You know, it's like people just line up. They want to know what's in it.
Oh, it's fascinating. Yeah. One more question in the chat from Will is, what is your take on Leo Zagami or people saying they left the Illuminati?
I don't. Oh, okay. I do. I think I roughly know who this is. I don't believe them. I don't believe that they were in like, Bootsy, you must have both. I mean, everyone on this call right now probably has gotten an email that was like, join the Illuminati. Send yes. $10,000.
Instagram.
I mean, there's very much, or
I get those all the time.
Of course, seriously, bro. They're fucking desperate.
So technically, if you send 10 grand and then you leave, you also were in the Illuminati and you're a defector and you can talk out against them. But I believe that people that claim to have been in some Illuminati and then left it again, great. They might have been in OTO or they might have been in some other special secret society that claimed Illuminati. They
claimed to protect all my family members and everything. Like, it's crazy. we're gonna save you from everything. It'll all be good. Just give us your money.
They're going to save you that. They're going to extend your car warranty. They're going to do like everything all at the same time. It's actually a big package deal. Yeah. That's how you know it's upsell. That's how you know it's the real Illuminati is because they lead with the Illuminati, but then everything else is included, right?
That's right, dude. It's a big package offer. You know, you're going to get a lot of bonuses and stuff, you know?
So, I mean, there's probably all kinds of people that either claim that they were in the Illuminati and affected. There's lots and lots of, like, I'm a huge fan of, like, Vigilant Citizen and Isaac Weissop's channel about everything. And like the claim someone's in the Illuminati now, like it, I have to take it with a grain of salt because Illuminati, again, it's either Bavarian Illuminati in 1770s that then became defunct after dude got ended in that, you know, you have to watch episode one to figure out how he got ended. It's a cool story ever.
It's so cool.
Or it's this Robert Anton Wilson version of like Bobby Boucher Illuminati, right? Like Terry Richardson, this photographer that takes pictures of devils and goats and stuff. He's got to be in the Illuminati. And Marina, she's painting blood on the walls and doing all these seances. And, you know, she's got to be Illuminati. Oh, that means Jay-Z and Lady Gaga. Like that Illuminati, I think, is a harder to kind of define because it's a more it's a symbolic Illuminati, right? It represents like a small clique of people that share some kind of information. Like, I do believe that there's a music industry Illuminati and a Hollywood Illuminati. Like, there's many Illuminatis now, but I don't believe that there is the Illuminati. Well, although they're they're just so secret now that they're doing it right this time.
I mean, how do you know that, you know, because all we're doing is reading history and other people's works and stuff. I mean, how do you know it wasn't a Hegelian dialectic to make it seem like they were taken out? I mean, you know, it's like there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, and especially in written history.
Well, I kind of think now that the most potent sort of secret society is probably just a boardroom freaking somewhere, a Zoom conference room, or it's a Slack channel with like 12 people in it, or
right.
You know, it's that it's private totally. Twitter group between Elon Musk and Bill Gates and fucking you know, Anthony Como or whoever else is in the group. It's like, that's the new Illuminati, essentially. Ordering pizza and hot dogs.
Oh my God, dude. That's so funny.
Walnut sauce.
Yep. Yep. So and lots of callbacks.
I think they're desperate too. They're desperate with all the symbolization and all the stuff that they're inundating our culture with. It's like they're grasping at the last tools that they possess. And you know, information and just the human spirit has, you know, continued on through all of the tyranny and all the control.
Well, I think that's the big secret. It's I probably bring this example up way too much, but the Mel Gibson movie Apocalypto, right? The whole premise of that freaking movie was that everyone believed that this top shaman really did control whether or not the sun was going to go away forever or not. And if everyone was just like, hey, I don't believe him, and just sat back, the sun would, you know, the eclipse would end and the sun would come back without this guy. But everyone was so afraid that if they didn't pay penance and they didn't, you know, they didn't pay their sacrifice, that he truly was going to prevent the sun from ever coming back and the world just ends. Like, who wanted to be the guy that was like, okay, maybe I was wrong, my bad, now the sun never comes back and the whole world ends? No one wants to be. It was like the ultimate Pascal's wager, right? It's like, maybe hell doesn't exist, but if all I got to do is just pray and I go to heaven, like, might as well hedge my bets. It was kind of that similar approach. But I think that still happens to this very day in every aspect of life, where it's like, oh, I need the blessing of this higher authority or some, you know, authority figure or, you know, parental figure or guardian figure. That's never the case. You never actually need anyone's permission to do anything, essentially. But I think that's the ultimate monopoly, right, is to convince someone else that you're an expert more than they could be. I think the best mantra ever is like, you know, every idiot that's ever accomplished something is an idiot about something, you know, like even Einstein fucking probably sharted in his pants on one occasion.
Well, he couldn't grow a plant. Like, Einstein couldn't grow a plant.
Well, and I heard that he couldn't tie his shoes when he was younger too. Like, there's certain things that just either didn't hold his focus or it just didn't click the same way. But again, it's like you find out that like, meet one of your heroes. Just go and meet any one of your heroes and realize, like, oh wow, they're actually kind of they're actually a little bit of an asshole. But that's actually, I mean, that could also be empowering of like, oh wow, my hero is just a fucking schmuck.
Just a
like,
fucking schmuck, bro.
No different than me.
I'm a schmuck. That means I could do that, you know? And I find that to be incredibly, I mean, that's probably what set me on my trajectory to do anything
badass.
Creative endeavor of seeing someone else and being like, well, that's not that great. And if, you know, they could do that, then I could probably at least try to do it.
Oh, hell yeah, dude. Whenever I get like unmotivated. Yeah. Whenever I get unmotivated in comedy, I just put on a comic that I fucking hate. And I'm just, fuck this guy. I'm going to write like 4 hours tomorrow.
Drop some names.
Bobcat Goldthwait.
I actually loved Bobcat Goldthwait.
I like Bobcat.
Pauly Shore.
I
like Pauly Shore too.
Pauly Shore is good. Man, yeah.
Now,
somebody's got to like him. They're listening.
Right, totally. Yeah, and I'm thinking even more of people who are around me peer-wise, you know, people who I see in the scene all the time who may have, like some clips and specials and stuff that I'm like, you know, or they did this or that. And or somebody that I just hate their opinion, right? Like, I can't really think of anybody off the top of my head that I think their take is just trash that, you know, would be... you know, maybe Hannah Gadsby or so. I don't know. Like, I'm just throwing stuff out there. I haven't even seen her special, so I shouldn't even say anything. But yeah.
Actually,
I mean,
I haven't watched TV in 20 years, so I couldn't even tell you who comedy.
Yeah, I think it's Amy Schumer. It's got to be Amy Schumer. That's from Honey. That's fair, dude. That's fair. You know,
yeah,
she put out one good special.
It's not funny.
She put out one good special, and then the rest of them have just been.
I mean, and we were talking before about how Hollywood and Washington, D.C. are just like obsessed with each other. And there's that direct link, right? Amy Schumer and Chuck Schumer. And it makes me wonder how far Amy Schumer would have gotten without the political clout on some aspect of it.
You mean the Trilateral Commission?
Yeah. The UN's putting up her new special. The Council on Foreign Relations presents.
Oh, now we can start talking about like what the bassist from Rage Against the Machine, Tom Morello, right?
Well, yeah. Jim Morrison's dad was an admiral in the Navy.
Oh, that's right, dude. He Gulf of Tonkin, right?
That's
he was
right.
Behind he one of the OG false flags.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so there's a lot of connections there. It's quite interesting.
I mean, when you get into Hollywood and the music industry, the ties to the military and politics, my go-to sort of saying is just like, how many coincidences will you tolerate until you consider a conspiracy? Like, that ship has sailed, you know, that Gulf of Tonkin ship has sailed long, long ago the different correlations between pop culture and military and everything else.
Well, the CIA's first film funding was at the Animal House or whatever it was, with the Charlotte,
Animal Farm?
And the Animal Farm, that's what it was.
Animal Farm.
And like, that was literally funded by the CIA. And if you look at the social dynamics in that film, I mean, that's like some heavy duty shit.
It is.
The pigs and the dogs and.
Yeah, there's definitely some symbolism there. For sure, for sure. Well, man, I had so much fun. I really appreciate both of your time and everybody's time. Thanks to everybody in the chat for making this a really fun and hilarious episode. I laughed a lot. I smiled a lot. And I, you know, appreciate that a lot.
Shout out to Skill Will for cracking me up the entire time.
Yeah, bro.
Oh, my man, dude. Yeah, much, much love. Paranoid American Thomas has an amazing several series of comics. Just can't come out with Juan and the Saturnian Cube, the Chosen One, and you have a lot of other stuff on Amazon too, Color and Books, all that cool stuff. But ParanoidAmerican.com, the link is in the description of the video. Go and check that out. Is there anything else, Thomas, that you want to plug or tell them about or places that they can go? I can throw some links in the chat.
Just follow the links, ParanoidAmerican.com, at ParanoidAmerican on Instagram. I wanted to leave this quote is what Michael Sarion opens up with, so it's fitting to kind of close with this. And it's a quote from a guy named Jeremy Campbell, and I can't remember what book it's from, but it's a book that Jeremy Campbell wrote. And what he writes here is that an important property of language is that while its symbols may be used to bring about physical results in the real world of substance, they need not be used for that purpose because symbols can be decoupled from our physical reality to a greater or lesser extent. Words are not deeds, although they often lead to deeds, and symbols can be manipulated to form new statements and expressions, which are only tentative, playful, and figurative. Symbols are at liberty to be a little irresponsible and experimental. And I had to read this thing like over and over and over. And every time it's like, it said something different to me. But again, it's going back to that idea of that a symbol can contain almost infinite layers and infinite messages, so much more than a statement or, you know, a page of words can. That page of words, you can read in a few different ways, but nowhere near the same ways that you can interpret that symbol and incorporate a symbol inside of you to make it mean things that it doesn't mean to anyone else. And that's such an important power that some people just, they don't even have that sort of awareness to like take a symbol and integrate it into themselves and use it as their own power instead of this like external thing that's exerting its influence over you. So just we should probably go on like a maybe another sort of appendix of this, of like self-defense course, right? The Illuminati self-defense.
The Illuminati self-defense handbook.
Like, hey, I love the sound of that.
And yeah, bro. We've got a long list that would be a fun one to go over. There's my departing.
Yeah, and your command of different fallacies and, you know, different ideas about like there's a whole lot. I would learn a lot. So I would love to be able to do that. That's fantastic. I would absolutely love it. James, tell people about the portal where they can find the Sonic Portal.
Oh, man, you can find me Sonic Portal, Instagram. And, you know, we're currently building a website, relaxsonic.org. And we're going to start a whole new era of sharing this medicine, for lack of a better word, right this minute, with the world and people who need it. You know, it's for the last 15 years, I've been, you know, performing for people at music festivals in an entertainment capacity, and the healing that I've seen has just been phenomenal, and the support that I've received has been phenomenal. And now we're really looking to expand out and start bringing this medicine to people who really need it, in you know, first responders and nurses and veterans who have all been victimized by 9/11 and by the wars and by the, you know, the recent pandemic and lockdown. And so these people are out there really trying to do their best and doing what they think is right, and they're suffering severe consequences. And, you know, I just want to give them a little bit of peace and vacation from their thought processes and share something powerful.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, check out the portal on Instagram. We'll definitely be forthcoming about the website, the nonprofit. That's fantastic. Awesome news, dude. Super
that's
excited.
Awesome, James.
Hell yeah.
Dude. Thanks.
So many cool things are happening, guys. I'm ecstatic. I'm booking shows. It feels good, you know, like I'm booking shows. I got a show up in the mountains this month. I'm doing Laughing Skull in Atlanta on the 1st. You know, I got a consistent show. I got a show at an authentic brewery down the road I can walk to on the 26th. Ah. So check me out. Follow on Instagram is usually where I'll kind of share that stuff, at Bootsy Greenwood on Instagram. If you're not on our email list, go to bluecollarmystics.org, and you can sign up and snag the Blueprint to Happiness. It has a little overview in there. It talks about like what we teach and what we like to talk about. And then you'll get an 8-day course on mentalism, which it all comes back to mind. We have a lot of really cool guides and different projects that we're going to be coming out with soon. I'm excited to share, and we'll do so in time. But check us out. Bluecollarmystics.org is the spot for now. Thanks so much for being here and hanging out with us live. So much fun to do it live. Can't wait for the next one. Thank you, Thomas, for being willing.
Yeah, thanks, Thomas.
Fucking dope show. I really, well,
thanks
really,
for you
really
guys, man.
It.
You're the ones that actually make this happen.
It's so much fun. I had a blast tonight. Thanks, everybody. And we'll see you guys next time.
Good night, gang.